Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 3:04 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is December 16th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. But I thought I'd kick off with the fintech sector. So this is Silvergate Capital, and it's been trending steadily lower for the last 5 months. And a decline of 80% in such a short period of time is meaningful. And of course, it's coming on the back of some very significant bankruptcies in the cryptocurrency sector. Then let's just think about how Bitcoin itself is doing. So it's down $530 today. Now, I'm going to show you this arithmetic chart first, where you have the big decline this year. And it stands out for an important reason, that we had the huge move in 2020, much larger in nominal terms than anything else we'd seen. But when we look at this on a weekly basis, and then as a logarithmic scale chart, where we get to see percentages rather than arithmetic scale, we perhaps get more insights. The most important thing to realize is that the people who are most interested in arithmetic scale tend to be levered, because it's really all about the number of points moved. So when a futures price goes from 10,000 to 60,000 for a given unit of risk, you get a lot more bang for your buck. But if you're unlevered, well, then it's the logarithmic scale chart is going to be more important. And the vast majority of people who are engaging in cryptocurrencies are unlevered. And of course, that's mostly the retail portion of the market. So I think that's rather important. Now, when we look at this chart, we can see a couple of different things. The first is that the price is still going down. This is still a downtrend. And another $500 decline in here today is a meaningful event, because Bitcoin's a liquidity barometer. And it tends to do best in times of excessive money printing. And there just happens to be this happy coincidence between the times when there is a halvening event, which is when the reward for mining or solving the equation to mint a new Bitcoin or series of new Bitcoins is solved. Well, the reward for that halves every 4 years. So the most recent halvening was in 2020. Prior to that, it was in 2016. And then there was another in 2012. So let's just pay attention to the fact that following the halvenings, you tend to not see much happening, and then prices multiply. And we saw exactly the same thing, that the price bottomed in 2015, didn't do much until after the halvening in 2016, and then multiplied. And of course, when we talk about multiplication factors in cryptocurrencies, well, then it goes up a lot. When in this occasion, it went from 400 to nearly 20,000. Then we had another low in the year before the halvening, a wobble at the beginning of 2020. The halvening came in around April, May, and then a multiplication factor. Now, on this occasion, it did not go up as much. It went from 8 to 60,000, which is not nearly as much as the move from 400 to 20,000. Every single one of these halvenings has occurred around the same time that we've had massive liquidity events. So if we then do the same thing and look at the size of the Fed's balance sheet on a log scale, well, then what we're going to see is this very strong coincidence. So we had a pop on the upside in 2008, and Bitcoin was created around that time. Then we had another surge in liquidity right at the end of 2012. Then we did not have another big surge of liquidity in 2016, but what we did have was a fiscal splurge. So we had the Trump tax cuts And lots of people got lots of money all of a sudden, and they spent it on Bitcoin. And then, of course, in 2020, we had the pandemic and the pandemic surge. So every time we've had a halving has just tended to coincide with this 4-year cycle in terms of how much money tends to get printed. Now we're looking at a rather interesting situation because we're back in a period of quantitative tightening. And periods of quantitative tightening have generally occurred before these splurges. So we had the original quantitative easing program in 2008. The size of the Fed's balance sheet contracted in 2012 and then multiplied. Then it contracted in 2018 through to the end of 2019 and then multiplied. And now it's contracting once more. So this is obviously creating a very well-defined pattern that's well understood. And it does, of course, then beg the question. And I really think this is the only question, because we're either going to see a continuation of this money printing, which is obviously going to then further inflate asset prices, or we're going to have a different environment. And everybody's trying to come up with an answer for what happens next. So I posted at Howard Marks' most recent memo yesterday, and he's talking about everything changing, and that he's lived through two enormous changes in his lifetime, and he believes that this may be the third. And the first two were the compression of interest rates, so that just completely eroded the discount rate and greatly enhanced the valuations. And then the era of quantitative easing. So the willingness of central banks to ride to the rescue and print money with no regard for the potential for inflationary pressures. And that worked for 14 years. And wage demand growth never really picked up. And we've seen lots of asset price appreciation and certainly lower living standards for many people. But not the kind of inflation that central banks measure, at least not until this year. So now we're at this, it really is the big question. Is the inflation that we see right now cyclical or structural? Because if it's simply cyclical, and we see that CPI inflation has surged on the upside, and we haven't seen rates like this for decades. So it's starting to come down. It's currently around 7%, and it didn't quite get to 10, but we're not at the same kind of very high levels that we saw for all of the 1970s. Rather than think about the peaks, perhaps more important is the fact that inflation trended from the mid-1960s all the way up until the early 1980s. We had a sequence of higher major reaction lows. And it's too early to say yet whether this is a new trend or an aberration. One of the contributing factors to the wage price spiral in the 1970s was the prevalence of union workers and wage demands tied to inflation. So when inflation went up, then it ne necessarily re there was a necessary response in terms of wage hikes to compensate workers. And of course, then that contributed to the wage price spiral. So we don't have nearly as many salary or union workers now, and certainly don't have the same knock-on effects in terms of inflation, although lots of public sector workers are certainly animating right now for higher wages. And there are lots of threats and real strikes going on from unionized workers, who are they have the collective bargaining power to negotiate higher wages. But it's not as broad-based as it would have been in the 1970s. And we're starting to see some of the factors that contributed to inflation, such as the supply chain issues, getting better. So, containers, the demand for containers went through the roof in 2021, and now it has pretty much fully unwound the entire advance. Obviously, there's a war going on in Ukraine, and there are big questions about the sustainability of munition dumps, because the rate at which artillery is being used greatly outstrips the capacity to replace it. So somebody's going to run out of bullets eventually. But what I find interesting is that the Baltic Dirty Tanker Index looks like it has peaked. So we're at least going to see an unwinding of the overbought condition and prices coming back down into that 1500 area. Now, inventories of various distillates are at low levels, so there is certainly an argument that there is a lack of available supply. But the bigger question then is about demand. And if we're looking at slowing economic growth, then it's unlikely that oil prices are going to be able to continue to hold these high levels. So we had a good sized rebound in oil prices over the last week. And now prices are starting to roll over once more, so down $2 in here today. And I suspect that we're going to see additional downside. So I think that when we take the balance of probabilities, that on the one hand, we have monetary conditions and we have quantitative tightening. And this is also now being deployed in Europe. So we're seeing an increasing global trend towards quantitative tightening. Then that's going to create a deflationary shock, because that's exactly what happened when the ECB put a trillion in and then took a trillion out. They created deflationary pressures. In 2019, there was a real fear of a permanent stagnation, and that there was going to be a lengthy period where interest rates might never be able to go back up because of deflationary forces. And I think lots of people will remember this discussion about the excess savings around the world, and those were compressing yields, and that was a trend that was never going to reverse. And then, of course, we had 2022, where inflation has roared back and interest rates have gone up exceptionally quickly. So, all that money that was printed in 2021 contributed to a lot of savings, and eventually those savings are going to be eroded. And when we reach the point where those savings are eroded, well, then people will simply not have any more money to spend, and then we're going to see a meaningful drop in retail. So, one thing I find interesting is that Amazon is trending downwards, and it doesn't look like it's over yet either. And obviously, Amazon is one of the biggest retailers in the world. Well, then, the biggest retailer is Walmart, and Walmart has been a real tower of strength, but it is now also rolling over. Costco is a crowd favorite, and it's also got very toppy characteristics. When we think about the kinds of companies that completely eschewed the internet, then TJ Maxx looks overbought in the short term and certainly susceptible to some additional downside. The kinds of companies that really came through the global financial crisis in really strong positions, like O'Reilly Automotive, where they sell parts to repair your car because a lot of people wouldn't be able to afford to buy a new one. Well, then they also look susceptible to some additional pause and consolidation. Now let's think about the upstart retail companies. So Shopify had been touted as a real competitor to Amazon in late 2021, and since then it has collapsed. Coming from about 175 down to 36 at present is a big move and now looks likely to continue lower, having unwound the overextension relative to the 200-day moving average. I think a good number of these newer companies, they look like good candidates for type 3 bottoms. So we're starting to see that oil prices are rolling over. Demand for retail companies are underperforming. And internet companies that have done enormously well from the rollout of 4G and very low interest rates, they're also significantly underperforming. And this is most particularly true when we look at the performance of the eight big meme companies relative to the wider market. And this is a completed type 3 top formation, and it is now trending down. The only thing you had to do for the last decade was own those eight companies, which are basically Facebook, Apple, Nvidia, Netflix, Google, Microsoft, and Tesla. Well, and the oh gosh, I've forgotten the last one. But the reality is that they all you had to do was own them, and you outperformed the wider market. And now, with them underperforming, all you really have to do is don't own them, and you can outperform the market. It doesn't mean the wider market is going up, but certainly you can avoid a lot of the downside pressure by simply not owning those eight companies. And that is allowing for the fact that some of them have probably bottomed. So Meta was, in fact, one of the best performers in here today. Even though it's closing out the day in negative territory, it was up 4% at one point. And it's still a downtrend overall, but it does look increasingly likely that it has bottomed because they have been cutting back on spending left and right. When they eventually avoid talking about the metaverse any longer, then I think there's significant room for recovery. The price right now is back where it was in 2016. But the big risk here is Apple. And Apple is still the largest company in the world. And this was a big move on the downside this week. And the one thing that Apple has done has held on better than just about every other large cap company, but it is now rolling over. And I suspect that there's a strong likelihood it is going to drop down and through the 1,000-day moving average. So this is obviously problematic. On the one hand, there is this big question about the long-term trend of inflation. But then the next question is whether these companies that have done so spectacularly well for more than a decade and have attained valuations in the trillions are capable of doing it again. And that, I think, is where the real risk is, that people willing to think that Apple is going to be able to double and triple from here, really are betting that we're going to have outsized money printing on a global basis that is going to enhance the spending power of billions of people. So they're all going to go out and buy new phones at the same time. And I just don't think that that's realistic in the next 18 months. And the one thing about Apple, again, very few people like talking about, is that it is highly cyclical. And most people don't buy a phone until the last one, the battery starts running out. And a lithium-ion battery has about 1,000 charges in it before they start losing charge in a significant manner. And that's give or take about 3 years. So I think Apple has real significant scope to decline regardless of what happens in terms of inflation. Well, then let's think about, well, what is it that central banks have been doing? They were terrified of deflation. And when they saw what happened during the global financial crisis, where there was this crash in housing and there was an acute need for financial sector deleveraging. So what they did was they cut rates to the bone, they printed money in untold quantities, then they artificially suppressed bond yields. And that allowed the banking sector to be recapitalized. Well, the net result then, on top of all of that, was that there was a huge round of new banking regulation. Well, then what that has meant is that lots of the conventional banks, they don't have the same kind of leverage to the economy and to the credit cycle today that they would have had 14 years ago. So banks aren't going to be the epicenter of risk on this occasion. But the most important thing to remember, though, is that banks are liquidity providers and they're not going up. In fact, they're going down. So the S&P 500 banks index is now encountering resistance in the region of both the 1,000 and 200-day moving averages. And then let's think about the regional banks index. And it's also rolling over and was down in really quite a dynamic manner in here this week. So this also looks like a type 3 top formation. And we're coming down into the region of the neckline. So there is really quite significant potential for a big drop. And banks tend to lead. So banks not performing, that's really not good news for the wider market. So central banks were terrified of deflation. Now they're terrified of inflation. And they haven't really had to deal with inflation for a long time. And inflation is something that is really debilitating because they're terrified of a wage price spiral. And at the moment, there is this tendency to think that there's going to be a benign outcome. And the benign outcome is entirely based upon the number of job openings. So what we have right now is an odd situation where there is, in the USA, there are 10 million available jobs and nobody to fill them. And it was 12 million 3 or 4 months ago. Now, one thing that I can say for certain is that I know Mrs. Tracy's business has been suffering because there's more competition for the primary product. And this is what happens on Amazon. You find a niche, you exploit it to the greatest of your ability, then your success breeds additional new supply. And lots of people start selling it, and your margins are compressed. So, this is exactly what happens in bull markets in the stock market, and it's exactly what happens in the retail sector as well. But her business is half this year what it was last year. And I suspect that based upon the performance of retail companies, this is also exactly what's happening, which tells me that there's going to be fewer people employed in retail in 2023 than there were in 2022 because there's less demand. And it also suggests to me that a lot of the savings that have been accrued over the last 2 years have been eroded. So this is an additional positive, I think, consideration to take into account. Now, we also hear from employers that they don't want to fire people because they're worried about not being able to hire new people. So you might hold on to people for longer because you're worried that they won't be replaced, or you won't be able to replace them, or you won't be able to encourage them back. And lots of companies have experienced exactly that problem during the pandemic. So we can see, for example, in airlines where there's lots of delays and baggage going missing, and it's because there just simply aren't the same number of people doing jobs, even as the demand for air travel has recovered. And there's going to be lots of companies in exactly that type of situation. But eventually, your business goes down enough that you worry less about firing people, and you start worrying more about survival. And then it's likely that a lot of companies are going to come to the same conclusion at the same time. And the number of job openings has already rolled over, and it's likely to contract further. And then the jobless numbers are not really trending yet, but they're not going down either. And of course, we have that huge spike. So the this to me, where it's likely that the 200,000 level will hold. And then we can go back and just look at what happened before the big pandemic, that unemployment was hovering around 200,000 between 2018 and 2020. And then during the pandemic, it just went bananas. And I don't think that's going to be repeated. That'll never be repeated. But we're now coming back down towards 2000. It's inevitable that unemployment is going to rise. Now, of course, there's also the issue that lots of people have retired, and there's less in the way of educated or highly skilled immigrants coming into the country. So then that's also contributing to the jobless rate staying low. But liquidity conditions continue to tighten. So we can look at the preferred measure of the yield curve used by the Federal Reserve. And it's down to negative 42 basis points. So we're in a very similar situation to where we were in 2019, but valuations are much higher now than they were then. And whatever about the stock market, where we've had a significant valuation contraction this year, the private sector, where there's private assets, then those have multiplied in value during the pandemic, and there hasn't been a real write down yet. Now, office vacancies are rising, and they've been empty for 2 years. So when those leases roll over, then there are very substantial commercial buildings are going to get handed back to the lenders, or handed back to the private equity companies. So this is certainly problematic, and it does suggest that what we should be looking at now is the real potential that there's going to be a recession in 2023, and that it could potentially be deep. I don't believe that it's likely there's going to be a shallow recession. This belief in Goldilocks, that can be achieved in an expansion when you're printing money into a global deleveraging. So you can achieve a Goldilocks scenario in those circumstances. But when you're dealing with inflation and excessive savings and over-the-top money printing, achieving a soft landing is something that's going to be exceptionally difficult to achieve because it's practically impossible to quantify the knock-on effects that you have from withdrawing that liquidity. But the one thing we know is that banking doesn't work when you have an inverted yield curve. And the extent of the inversion now is similar to where it was in 2006 and 7 and in 2000. So I think that we certainly are looking at a recession in 2024, excuse me, 2023. And it's really only a question of how long it takes for unemployment to begin to rise. But the Federal Reserve and other central banks, they have no reason to stop tightening liquidity until unemployment begins to rise. So the most benign scenario is that they raise rates enough to kill off inflation, and inflationary pressures come back down and take pressure off of the interest expense of governments. The one thing that we've seen in both the USA and in Europe is that when you have quantitative tightening, it initially leads to rising rates, which is exactly what we've had this year, and then subsequently yields contract. So the logic is simple enough that yields go up first because investors are worried that they're being crowded out of the market by the central bank selling bonds. And with all of that additional supply, prices go down, yields go up. But then, because eventually people start worrying more about deflationary forces and the threat of a recession, then yields start to contract. So that's what we're seeing right now. Now, yields are still hovering here in the region of the peak from earlier this year. So this is still a reasonably consistent uptrend. And then, of course, it begs the question, how high are short-term interest rates going to go? And of course, this is also another major point of contention, because the bond market isn't willing to give any credence to the view that the Federal Reserve is going to continue raising rates throughout the year. And instead, the Fed is basically saying that they're going to keep going until the job is done. But lots of investors who've been around the block for the last 20 years, maybe even 30 or 40 years, well, they've all been conditioned to expect that the Fed will continue to talk about fighting inflation right up until the very point when they cut interest rates. Because that is what they have done every other time. So now, as we appreciate what we've learned from history, and we already see that inflation is at uncomfortably high levels, do the lessons that have been learned over the last 40 years still apply? I think that was the main point that Howard Marks was trying to make. And I rather think that we're more likely than not to be in a higher interest rate environment going forward. And I think that central banks are sufficiently chastened that they're not going to engage in the same kind of abundant money creation unless they get really worried about deflation. And then they're less likely than previous to leave that liquidity in the market longer than it is strictly required. Now, if that's correct, then it's likely that yields will contract, but that they will not go back down to the lows in 2020, and that instead yields will stay higher for longer, and that we will have yields hovering somewhere between 2 and 4% for an extended period. And when we look at the long-term chart, well, we've completed the base formation. The sequence of lower rally highs has very clearly been broken, but it hasn't been the most consistent trend in the world. So that also suggests that we are going to need clear evidence of not just that the yield comes back down and bounces, but that it then pushes up through the previous peak. And I think that we're at the point right now where yields have gone up enough that investors are willing to look at the fact that a yield of 3.5% is a lot more than anything we've seen for a decade. And that in the credit markets, you can secure yields of 6 or 7% in comparatively sound credits. And in that kind of environment, well, then you can make money from fixed income. And you can achieve your long-term goals of just achieving a 6 to 7% yield in a pension. And that, of course, puts downward pressure on long duration assets, the kinds of things that aren't making money today, but they promise to make money in future. So I think that's kind of where we are right now, that the longer we have these higher interest rates, the more pressure is going to come to bear on the technology sector. So this is looking increasingly likely that the boom in promises is over, and that in future we're going to be looking at facts, real money, real cash flows, real dividends, and less about the promise of profits, the promise of market share, and the promise of technological innovation. I think at this stage, a lot of people have become less than enthused about the promise of technology. I think most people understand that for the convenience that technology provides, then it creates additional inconvenience. I think about that with my Shopify subscription. There was a time when you would simply have bought the album and then you play it as often as you want. Whereas now you don't buy the album, but you'd pay Shopify a couple of $100 a year for a family subscription and you listen to whatever you want. It's a very different business model. And of course, we've had this subscription convenience business model derived over the last decade, and it prospers in a strong economic environment. And when everyone has plenty of money, then what we have is a clear movement towards convenience. But when there's less money about, when there's less spending, then it greatly or it puts a lot of pressure on those subscription business models. Because a subscription business model is only good when you've actually got subscribers. And as spending contracts, then people start looking at what they're spending money on. And Microsoft has also been one of the companies that held on best, but it's also pulling back from the region of the 200-day moving average. And the massive move higher from 2013 onwards was in response to the adoption of the subscription business model. And now that price is starting to come back down. So we know where the risks are, and we know what's been doing best. We know what's been doing over the last decade and how much downside potential there is. So where are the opportunities going to be? Well, I think that the one thing that we learned from the pandemic is that there's real potential for growth in biotechnology. Now, the biotechnology index is in negative territory today, and it looks likely to unwind the short-term overbought condition. I think that it's still a little early to get super enthused about biotech, but it's certainly outperforming. And Moderna popped on the upside in here this week and then came back down again by the end of the week. So it looked like it was completing its base formation. Now, one of the reasons that I like healthcare is because there's the real potential for them to create products to treat unmet needs. So we have mRNA as it's going to be applied to immuno-oncology. And then you have companies like Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk, which are providing obesity drugs. And they are selling out. So that's contributing to the strong performance in those shares. But these are idiosyncratic themes that are outside of the broad macro framework, because healthcare is totally essential. When somebody is sick, they need to be treated, and they'll find the money to pay for it eventually. Then we can think about the rising geopolitical tensions. So when we think about Moderna, the fact that it really dominated the biotechnology sector during the pandemic, that really helped to highlight the fact that vaccines were the go-to market in 2020 and 2021. Now, Pfizer is pulling back from the $55 level, and it looks like we're going to see some additional ranging in here. The problem for the global economy is that China is now going through its COVID crisis. They adopted this very strict protocol for vaccinations in 2020, and they held on to it for 2 years and successfully kept the virus at bay for a really prolonged period. And the price of that was social unrest, and now they've completely abandoned it. So when we think then about the Chinese economy, they're going to have the same kind of hit to growth that everyone else did in 2020. And they've already announced almost $1 trillion in supports for the property sector. So the fiscal measures are being put in place to tackle some of these challenges. But they still haven't gone through the pandemic surge, and it's coming. The infectivity rate for the Omicron variant is higher than both the original and the Delta variant. Now, there's some people say that it's as contagious as measles, but it really doesn't matter whether it's up to 18 18 people for every infected person is going to get infected by that person, or whether it's 10 or 7. As long as it's more than two, then the virus is going to spread. And it's very likely that when you have a large population that haven't been inoculated against it, it's going to ramp higher in numbers. And it's going to have a knock-on effect in terms of consumer demand. And I still think that the best way to monitor that is through copper. So copper prices are pausing in the region of the 200-day moving average. And they were steady-ish in here today. And the reason I think copper is a good way to measure it is because China is the biggest consumer of copper, the biggest smelter of copper, and then also the biggest producer of electric vehicle batteries. And the electrification of the global economy is where a lot of the expectations are that we can, I guess the expectations are where new demand is going to come from. So that's where I think we can think about the outlook for copper. So if we're going to have a new big bull market in electrification, copper prices should rise. If China goes through a recession, copper prices will fall. Of course, that will then create lower commodity prices and enhance the argument that electric vehicle demand will increase. But they're very finely balanced arguments. And oil prices continue to decline because demand is rolling over. So we have the prospect that the first quarter of next year is going to be quite problematic in terms of global growth. But after that, China's infectivity rate for the coronavirus will peak. And when that happens, then all the fiscal measures that have been implemented now, they're going to be fully evident within the economy. So we could then potentially see commodity prices rebounding in a very emphatic fashion. Well, then we can think about the war in Ukraine. So there's obviously a couple of different topics that are worth considering. The first is that when we look at what's going on in Ukraine, the most important thing that's going on is that they're firing tens of thousands of munitions in artillery every day. So that's outstripping the ability of countries to increase their arsenals. Well, eventually one of them is going to run out of weaponry, and then that's going to raise some important questions. It's certainly going to be a big question for Ukraine and whether they can continue to repel Russian aggression. So that's one. But then for all the other major powers in the world that haven't been involved in the war, well, they still have all of their munitions, and then they have a competitive advantage. Well, Japan is increasingly alert to that fact that in the event that the war in Ukraine goes on for another year and the arsenals that the USA and NATO have are run down relative to Russia, or that Russia's and theirs are both run down, then China's going to be in an exceptionally advantageous competitive position. So Japan is now starting to talk about building offensive weapons, and they still have their pacifist charter in the Constitution. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to defend themselves. So we're going to see a massive rearmament. There are going to be significant infrastructure bills passed to build the factories, to start up steel production in the rest of the world outside of China. China's by far the largest producer of steel, and that's currently being deployed in building infrastructure and building lots of properties. But it could equally be redeployed into the military industrial complex. So it's very likely that the 2020s are going to result in a significant rearmament, and that's going to be a global phenomenon. So even though we have these debt loads and we're still going to have a lot of infrastructure development, then we can think about the fact that the war in Ukraine has also rammed home the point to governments around the world that energy independence isn't just something nice to have, it's totally essential. And the USA has already achieved energy independence. North America is largely already energy independent. Europe is a long way from there. And Russia and China are likely to become increasingly more entwined. And China is Saudi Arabia's largest customer. So they're going to also have closer relationships over time. One thing that I found especially interesting, that I found really very surprising when I was in Saudi Arabia in January, was every person I met who worked for the public investment fund was from China. So Saudi Arabia has hired Chinese nationals to help it to run its sovereign wealth fund. Now, I'm not making any comment on the suitability of those individuals, how learned they are, qualified they are, decisions they make, but the fact that they're universally Chinese and not from any other country, well, that's a clear indication of where the focus of attention is. And they are as wedded to their customers today as they were at any point in history. It's just that today their customers are different than they were 40 years ago. And the Saudi Arabian index is pausing now in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, but it's still very linked to the oil sector. Then you also have the domestic mining sector, and that share has held up significantly better. They're developing copper mines, lithium mines, nickel mines, and refining capacity in the Middle East. So the share is pulling back in tandem with industrial metal prices. What's also particularly interesting this week is that China's created a unified buying program for iron ore. And this is in direct response to the oligarchy in the production of iron ore. So Rio Tinto was a little bit softer in here today, and BHP Billiton, which also tends to have energy as well as iron ore, was also a little softer. The one thing that I think is especially worth highlighting is that it's quite normal to see a very strong performance by resources companies in the latter stages of a bull market, and that's exactly what we're seeing right now. I think that there are going to be some wonderful opportunities when this bear market has run its course. And there are going to be massive infrastructure projects. There is going to be a continued drive towards electrification. And the innovation that we saw this week with the first net energy from a fusion reaction, that's a real game changer. It means that we're going to have a step higher in terms of energy production. Now, it doesn't mean it's going to happen in the 2020s. But it is worth considering that the lasers used to compress that pellet of helium into hydrogen, well, those lasers were built in the 1980s. And laser technology has improved considerably in the intervening 30 years. So there is the potential that we're going to see innovation in fusion accelerate now because money is going to flow into it. The one big drawback from fusion over the last 60 years has been nobody could do it. And there were lots of questions. There was always this topic that fusion is 15 years away, and it always will be. But now that we have net energy gain, then that's really a game changer. And it means that there will be companies developing this technology. The big bet has been on tokamaks because it would have been the easiest way to build a power plant if it was proved to work. And the laser compression is a different way of doing it. So it has achieved net energy gain, but it might be harder to develop a power plant out of it and to create a succession of reactions. So we've demonstrated that fusion is possible, and now the big question is how do we commercialize it? But that's the big step. The next step, these aren't as difficult. And money will flow into it. And now, this is, I think, one of the most important points that we get massive big bull markets when energy prices are low. And we get secular bear markets when energy prices are high. So, if we are in a situation where global supply chains are disrupted, where great power competition is elevated, then that will put upward pressure on energy prices. It will introduce a high discount rate. It will necessitate much greater government involvement in order to backstop speculative investments. And then those speculative investments will need to fill a real fundamental goal. So it's going to have to serve the public good or serve a geopolitical need. I do think that semiconductors are going to be much less of an issue going forward. The Philadelphia Semiconductors Index had a downside Q reversal in here this week. The Nasdaq 100 had a downside Q reversal in this week. And the Eurostoxx Index had a big downside weekly Q reversal this week. In the short term, the balance of probabilities is that we're going to have a big decline. And then we're going to see what happens after that. So when we think then about the outlook for the next quarter, I suspect that the balance of probabilities is for lower prices. China should then start to recover. That will help to support speculative activity in the commodities sector. So that will provide a buy the dip in environment for commodities generally. We're going to see a lot more concentration on infrastructure development, and rearmament is going to really boost demand for heavy industry. But then energy is something that's going to be a big question. And how much money and what kind of regulatory environment is going to have to change in order to really encourage new investment in supply? And that's a big question because this whole global warming topic isn't going to disappear easily. There's been a huge move in terms of sentiment about global warming. But now the harsh realities of trying to deal with a recession and preserve living standards while also reducing carbon, these are not easy questions to answer. So I suspect that there's going to be a much more level-headed conversation about an energy transition rather than this assumption that no one's going to be using carbon within the next 5 years. I think that is not something that's going to really be possible. And I suspect that we're going to have a fusion reactor within the next decade, and that it will not be a government organization, but that it'll probably be done by a private organization. And then that will enter, or that will be the dawn of a whole new energy environment. And I think with that, I'll leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.